Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do, from Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Good afternoon and welcome to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. It's 27 minutes left to the hour of 5. So Home Run is here from Home Run runs, no pun intended, from 4:30 to 6. So if you just tuned in, welcome wherever you tuned in from. Just enjoy the show. Relax if you're seated at home. Just eyes on the road and all the focus on the road minus the ears. You know, those ones can multitask. But attention, maximum attention on the road because we want you to keep listening. And today's discussion is going to be one interesting one. As always, I mean, it's Home Run with Helmut and Dwight. Duh. So we talk about Africa because talking about Africa in general, that's a very broad discussion. Now, we are going to talk about Africa in a sense that, multiple, you know, points of entry. We have an interview that was conducted by HT here at home. Here at the studio, actually, conducted. It's something that's coming from internal, the courtesy of HD, and we have also two discussions that focuses on Africa, but they're coming from outside of Africa. One is coming out of Dubai in the UAE, featuring the president of Sierra Leone, the president of Zimbabwe, and yours truly, Tucker Carlson, former Fox News. Too much to get into on Tucker Carlson. He's an interesting guy. They just met with several African leaders and the president of Botswana was also the Duma Boko, where he asked very interesting questions. He had awesome questions that are very, I'm setting a trap for you, Tucker Carlson type of questions. Which I like. I mean, I enjoyed that type of violence. I enjoy that type of violence now, especially when it's taking place in the media space, because I have watched a little too much of Mehdi Hassan, especially when he was still with Al Jazeera. Now, look, Tucker Carlson asked questions, but the leaders I'll give you an example. It seems that when it comes to the replacement, population replacement, population upkeep, a lot of countries, especially in the developed world, a lot of developed countries are facing population decline. But a lot of countries in the developing world, aka developing countries like, Namibia, for example, there is a population incline, as in the population is increasing. Now, why is population important? It's because you cannot talk about economic productivity in a long run without a workforce. You need a workforce. You don't want a workforce. You need a workforce. If you are looking at, at economic growth 10, 20 years, 100 years in the future, you need a workforce. So, Sierra Leone, from the look of things and they have received, global recognition for this, that they are one of the countries, they are the countries at the top of population, at the top of population replacement. In other words, there are more people being born than those that are going in retirement and Espiritu Santo, those that are kicking the bucket. So the question came this way. So, Mr. President, from the look of things, one of the strengths that your country, and I'm paraphrasing him, one of the strengths that your country has is that there's a high number of births in your country. So what can you tell us, like, how are you using that, how are you exploiting that advantage? How are you doing that? Two, how are you exploiting that advantage to your country's advantage? Of course, economically speaking here. Oh dear. One, according to their you know, according to the gentleman, the president, he pointed out that their education system is somewhat similar to the one that we have here. He didn't use the word free or subsidized, but he did. Yeah, he actually said that you can go to school, I think, from, call it from kindergarten all the way to high school. I think it spills into tertiary, but just to be safe, I'm just going to go all the way to high school, but so school is free there. Like, you can go to school without having to worry about school funds and all that. Still have to worry about bullies if you don't have muscles like yours truly here. But that's what he points out, which is a very brilliant point to make. So education investment-wise, they're doing great as a country to sort of like cater for the, you know, for the increase in population so that the parents cannot, you know, don't have to worry about how do I send 5 of my kids to school for this amount of money, school fees. So that part is taken care of. But he opens with a joke. That very wonderful statement that I just paraphrased, he opens with a joke. And the point he made was, in Sierra Leone, again paraphrasing here, in Sierra Leone, we work very hard both during the day and during the night. I was like, huh? Honorable President, you are representing Africa. So, as Your Excellency, when you say something like that, a short Kavango comedian somewhere in West Africa is embarrassed on your behalf. What do you mean you work hard both at night and, to be fair, well, we all know what he means. It's reflected in their population statistics. The same cannot be said about some countries in in Southwest Africa. Don't want to mention any names. But, gentlemen, Valentine's Day is coming. We could copy a thing or two from Sierra Leone. I'll stop there. So, school is taken care of. And that discussion is actually, is a little too painful to watch. It's a little too painful to watch because, one of the questions that the president of Botswana was asked was, because one of the things that they're looking at is, obviously Europe is having an immigration problem here. And in the US, they are dealing with ICE, it's immigration problem, basically, for the most part of developed countries. And most of these immigrants are coming from developing countries. So it was only fair for Tucker to ask a question of, what is Botswana doing to sort of like combat, to make sure that the youth does not leave the country because there is a lot of potential in the youth? You have to understand that, it's Jim O'Neill back in the 2000. This is a very brilliant economist with Goldman Sachs at the time, told his government and basically the developing world, because it was public knowledge, that economic prosperity is swinging in the direction of developing countries. So if you want to make it, trade relations with countries, if you want to make diplomatic relations with countries on which trade relations are built on, you want to make friends with Russia, China, Brazil, South Africa. These are emerging economies. This is an economist in the year 2000 telling politicians the best course of direction to take in terms of economic investment, economic direction with regard like investments and diplomatic relations, because for countries to trade, diplomatic relations is very important, because on diplomatic relations, that's where economic relations is built on. That's the foundation. If they are busy insulting each other diplomatically, trading is not going to go very well for the most part. And I'm saying for the most part because, sometimes leaders can exchange insults, but companies will be like, okay, heck, let's trade. You know how back in 2022, when Western media went bananas, let's punish Russia, let's get all the Western countries out of Russia. And we're all like, Nike left, Apple left, and this is where technicalities now is very important. They didn't leave. They just changed names. Let me give you an example. If Botswana is buying 3 million pairs of Nike shoes a year, and then you see Yeah, and then South Africa goes to war with, South Africa goes to war with Namibia. And, now to punish South Africa, all multinational companies decide to say, you know what, they're going to withdraw out of South Africa. Then all of the sudden, Botswana that was buying 3 million pairs of Nike shoes per year, they are buying 100 million Nike pair of shoes per year. And the biggest country they are selling those shoes to, they are exporting those shoes to after importing them, is South Africa. At this point, you can see what's going on here. It's just the technical language that's being exploited here. They didn't leave. So, we have a commercial break coming up. We'll continue on the other side. Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM.
Celebrate your loved ones with ShopRite this Valentine's Day with a wide range of everything you need for the perfect gift. Celebrate love and low prices with great deals like a 100 mils Gold Series Ladies Perfume, all variants, for only $49.99 each. And Red Velvet or Valentine's Cake for just $109.99 each. Celebrate love and low prices this Valentine's Day. Offers valid until 15 February 2026. Only at ShopRite.
Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do. From Namibia, Africa, and around the world, tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
And welcome back to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. It's a Thursday, it's the 12th. We only have one day in between before people have started going flower shopping. And so congratulations, guys, you know. Keep up. But you know, if you were listening from the beginning, then I already appealed to the broader Namibian public, especially those ones that are looking forward to Valentine's Day. Sierra Leone is beating us night population game. So let's
The what population game?
No. Okay.
In Vision 2030.
Okay. Look. Not that. You might. You know. Maybe you missed this part. Turns out. When it comes to population, you know, population, like increase. You are looking at you are looking at the ratio between death and birth rates here.
Mm.
Death and birth rates and retirement rates. So you can see where the population is headed in terms of, there's a population increase, a population replacement, if you can call it that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sierra Leone is one of those countries that is actually at the top of their game.
Meaning they've got 5 births per woman?
They have a very high...
And that out of those 5 births, there's like 2.5 girls?
They have a very high birth rate.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, one of the questions the president of Sierra Leone was asked was, this seems to be an advantage for a population if you are looking at a future economic workforce wise. Yeah. This is an advantage for your country. So, what are you doing to take advantage of this? First of all, how are you guys doing this too? What are you doing to take advantage of this clearly? What is an advantage for your country?
Yeah.
Well, his first answer was, in Sierra Leone, we work hard both during the day and at night. I'm like, Your Excellency, come on.
Okay, I didn't get that part. Because he technically only said one good thing, which was in the start of the talk, meaning specifically, get the basics in terms of infrastructure, right?
Yeah.
And then a country can build from there. And then the South Africans pitched in. I'm talking about the two South Africans, the listeners that were on the same panel. They pitched in and then it was just, okay, let the South Africans talk. The other, let the Sierra Leonean, let the president, the Sierra Leonean president, let him just keep quiet.
That part is in the Tucker Carlson discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. The World Economic Forum, I think, like Your Excellency, that's your best answer. On an international platform.
You're going to be talking about working hard at day and night.
Like, homeboy got jokes.
He's good. You know, and I'm glad no one picked up on the joke because everyone was just looking serious. Anyway, on a serious note.
So,
dear listeners, we actually have a couple of audios lined up for you just to sketch the image, as well. Primarily because the one is an excerpt from the World Economic Forum discussion about where to for Africa. I just summarized that part, primarily, but they were talking about, you know, what should Africa do going ahead? And then in this past week or in the earlier half of this week, our colleague, Hende had a interview with the South African economist, Wandile Sihlobo, talking about, you know, Southern African aspects, AU, AFCFTA and SACU. You would also hear primarily in terms of the two audios, how they technically assist each other in terms of the discussions. Both are like not super long. We've got a 6 minute, 10 minute, you know, allocation for each. However, they set the scene in helping you understand primarily what should be the thinking going ahead. Now, there are some elements, give or take. There are developments that have happened in last week and in this week as well. To also take in consideration, this is more an approach of looking at how do you achieve the integration that's best suited for each other. Now, this is primarily what the AFCFTA tries to, or is preaching, not trying, they are preaching it. Mm-hmm. It is, however, not as simplified as possible. And I think Stredom, the guy from the World Economic Forum, he also describes it best because he literally went and said, listen, if you are a large financial institution as themselves, like Old Mutual, and we're not talking about Old Mutual Namibia, this is South Africa,
yeah.
Because they've got an Old Mutual Africa strategy themselves. He cited specifically that thinking of Africa like 55 countries, 55 different currencies, 55 different products, 55 different marketing strategies, 55 different investment strategies, 55 different portfolios you've got to develop for investors. That is a lot of work.
Yep.
However, if you had a and this is the thing, Helmut, we should achieve, even though it's in the framework for the you know, the progression of the AU.
Yeah.
Even if it's in the framework. He literally said the sentence that we've spoken about, the backwards to front approach that the AU has taken, because the EU went and said, let's start becoming a common market. Let's move gradually to becoming the common market area.
Yeah.
We are starting politically and then trying to go economically. And now we're trying to figure out how do we achieve these common market elements together? AFCFTA is supposed to be the template of achieving this, but it's literally like Stredom says, if you've got 55 different currencies, it's a difficult strategy. However, if you look at the EU, 27 nations, one currency, one fiscal and monetary strategy, it's straightforward stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah. They highlight, and obviously, a discussion that's also lined up between, Hende and Sihlobo, themselves build off and leverage from these particular talking points that one, what's the guy's name from, AFCFTA? I almost said Wandile Mene. It's not his first name. But yeah, Mene from AFCFTA. He literally goes and says, listen, we can't speak about we wish to be there. We are aiming to be there. You know, having missions and visions constantly, not saying we are there.
Now, look at it this way. Let's go back to the 2000s.
Yeah.
Yeah. James or Jim O'Neill, Goldman Sachs, tells basically the whole world that the economic, economic growth is swinging in the direction of developing countries.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the next 10, 20 years, you are going to see, an increase in the progression of economic growth in faster in developing countries than it will be in developed countries.
Yeah.
Because in developed countries, there is going to be a decline. Now, interesting enough, they seem to be, you know, now economic growth decline and population decline in a lot of developed countries seems to be directly proportional.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in a lot of developing countries, economic growth and population growth seems to be, again, directly proportional. It seems like there's something about population and, you know, population growth and economic growth.
Mm.
Yeah. Things, you know, for the most part, I feel, if the population that's big enough have access to products, consumption is obviously going to be higher than in countries that does not have, population big enough.
Mm.
So that makes sense. Now, when the Jim O'Neill guys started doing the economic focus that brought about the whole BRICS discussion, this is where a lot of countries, both developed and developing, should have woken up to say, you know what, in a developed countries should have woken up to say, you know what, we need more friendly, foreign relations with the developing countries, because that's where the economy is going.
Mm.
And also, therefore, on this friendly foreign relations, we establish very also friendly economic relations, like trade relations.
Yeah.
Except the opposite happened. It was just in last year's U.S. national security strategy. That's when I think and Africa is on the last page, by the way, and they're saying now it's high time we shift from from a foreign aid donation type of relationship, especially with Africa, and build a more equal partnership trade relations.
Mm.
Now, is that Jim O'Neill, that guy, still alive? Because if I was him, I would be laughing. I would be walking around with a shirt written, "I told you so." Now, developing countries.
Well, he'll first argue you with weird graphs and data sets that you would not have access to, because
you won't have answers.
No, you won't have access to them, because primarily these data sets would be things that, in some cases, you would not have access to, primarily because it would be contained in another country and you never knew such an entity collected such information.
Yeah. Now, for Africa, why are we only figuring out now that trade is more important than political parties? Because we should, if you ask me, we should have picked it up from the very same example I used.
Yeah.
And basically said, okay, you know what? If the economic growth, is swinging in our direction, then we have to take advantage of it. Except we didn't. To this day, we are still heavily reliant on the extractive industry.
I mean, Hamul, which has been the talk of our discussion yesterday, where it basically looks like we are walking, talking, preaching the Dutch curse.
Yep.
We're not yet acting in the Dutch curse scenario, but it is so difficult. I mean, the whole reason, and this is a discussion that took place on the side of that EITI event of last week that I attended by the IPPR. On the side, I asked the people, so what's the feeling you guys get as civil society regarding your interactions with the ministries? And this system is now going to be, is it two ministries plus the presidency? So it's Ministry of Trade, Minister of International Relations with Trade, and Ministry of Mines and Energy with its industries component. And now with the presidency obviously involved in the discussion.
Yeah.
Because this is now going to be a director general or deputy director general, whatever the person's post might be, that the Petroleum Act or the new petroleum amendments to the Petroleum Act is proposing. So the conversation that I literally, extrapolated from at that EITI discussion on the side, the conversations on the side, was that the civil society guys don't understand why the government is pushing a narrative saying that oil production will happen by 2030. I don't know why. We literally debunked that according to the report, the Deloitte report. And the Deloitte guys clearly state in that report, which is a report commissioned by the government itself, that literally all production will only take place after 2030. No production will take place before or in 2030. all production will take place after 2030.
I think it's, there are some type of production that's going to start in 2030, but that will be, cross your fingers, production. That's not based on numbers. And I wouldn't rely on that because the report, like you said, commissioned, is just giving you the approximate time frame that is putting production in 2024, 2025 and up.
And an approximate, you use that word.
Approximate.
Let's fixate on that word of approximation.
Yeah.
An approximation is a conservative estimate.
Yeah.
Which says this could even be longer than this. This could even be further down the line. So that technically means it's not even a definite of my estimate by the numbers that were mentioned there of 2034.
Yeah.
So this could be after 2034 as well.
Actually.
So two presidency terms from now.
So who is going to be his or her excellency, President Oil?
from
some of these things just comes out, I swear.
Ah, Helmut, no, man. You'll have us beat up before we even reach the gate by now, man.
Can we get to the audios?
Yeah, we can get to the audios. So how are we going to structure for you to listen to the audios to listeners? You're first going to listen to the World Economic Forum interaction with the interviewer. He's obviously an American from the CNBC Africa department. But it's the first person you'll hear is Johan Strydom. And then the second speaker that will be asked regarding the AfCFTA's particular goals will be Mr. I just want to make sure about that AfCFTA guy's name because I had it. Mr. Mene, in terms of his particular explanation. Yeah, his name is also Wamkele. Well, the other guy's name is Wandile. Oh. So it's Wamkele Mene and Wandile Sehlobo.
HD discussion.
Yeah, the HD discussion. So we'll first start with the WEF extract or excerpt for you to listen in terms of laying the foundations for our discussion. And secondly, the Wandile Sehlobo interaction with our colleague here from Eagle FM, Hende Wangele.
Walenga.
Walenga. Yay! There's a lot of
You're on fire.
There's a lot of W's going on here. Oh, no, dear listeners. Have a listen.
Both, because I think there are challenges. I think I broke the system.
It's usually economists that say on the one hand or the other.
So I think there are opportunities and challenges. I think with the lens from an old mutual, and our work, I mean, we are across 11 markets. What we do is go into a market and channel kind of domestic savings into domestic investment. I mean, that's kind of the simplest way to put it. So we're kind of intermediaries.
Yeah, people are paying you insurance premiums and you've got all those assets to go invest.
Insurance, asset management, retail banking in certain places. So institutions like us create the kind of economic, the financial ecosystem to be able to drive domestic investment. So without that, it's very hard to drive domestic investment. So I think the opportunity that there is in our lifetime to kind of see a leapfrogging of financial inclusion and financial participation in places that I think absent digital technology would have been very hard to envisage. So whilst it's by no means an easy pathway, if you look at the trends around mobile adoption, you look at payment adoption. So you look at the rate at which, I mean, we have a payments platform that we've pioneered in Zimbabwe, which is one of our oldest markets, that has gone to 2 million users in a matter of 18 months, even though there is an existing banking system in place. It's drawing informal people onto the platform. We're looking to move that into some other markets. But the point is that if you can include people, if you can get data on people, then you can do risk underwriting, you can do credit underwriting. I do think if you look at it from a big picture point of view, there is a world in which we have far more Africans, far more of the African youth actually participating in a way that you can channel savings into investment, and you can start to create places that are not viable necessarily for financial institutions to operate in can become viable far quicker than I think in previous generations.
Yeah, I can see why you had two hands up, because on the one hand, if you have reliable internet, reliable electricity, you have that young, energetic, entrepreneurial population ready to adopt all these new tools, but you do need some of the infrastructure the president talked about to get there. Wamkele, you know, you're trying to build kind of a piece of the infrastructure, the regulatory infrastructure, if you will. We're just, 10 months after Liberation Day. Tariffs are now top tier issue discussed mm-hmm. all over the world. Countries are trying to respond to that. We saw the EU just sign a deal with Mercosur, you know, developing their own new trade ties. And Africa's responding too, right? This is a long story about African countries not trading well together. And in fact, I remember some of my first trips to West Africa being told, hey, if you want to travel from one country to the other, you got to go through Paris. And I said, that's crazy. And I tried to show everyone they were wrong. And boy, they were right. It was not easy to get around. And trade barriers are one of those parts of the story. So you've got real momentum now to change that.
Yeah.
Tell us about the trade story, and is it an unlock to the concerns the president has raised?
Well, thank you very much. First, let me just say I don't disagree with the president, as a disclaimer.
You're allowed to do that here in Davos, okay?
We have over 60 years of a fragmented market. We have 42 currencies. We have a degree of industrial development that is underdeveloped to the extent that we as a continent, all 55 of us, contribute only 3%, less than 3% to global trade. The cost of infrastructure is high. AFDB estimates it to be about $150 billion annually. The cost of transport and logistics continues to be high. Movement of persons is difficult outside of ECOWAS and outside of the East African community. So we've got a number of these barriers. However, in the wisdom of our heads of states, they said this is not sustainable. We are a continent of 1.4 billion people with a combined GDP of 3.4 trillion United States dollars. That is consumer spending and business spending. But if we don't accelerate integration of the market, we shall forever be a continent of potential. And we will never realize that potential. So we now have a free trade area. 50 countries have ratified it, which of course is a legal commitment, but it also signals political will amongst the 50 countries that we must accelerate reduction, elimination of intra-Africa barriers to trade, intra-Africa barriers to investment. Intra-Africa investment is at only 4% because of this fragmentation and these divisions that have existed for a long time. We now have completed all of the negotiations that the heads of states directed the ministers of trade to undertake to create this single market. So we are rapidly transitioning from negotiations to implementation. And at the heart of that will be exactly the points that have been made, the cost of infrastructure, transport and logistics, and the cost of money, particularly for young people, the cost of trade finance, which continues to be very, very high. And so I think that whilst we are in an unprecedented assault on the multilateral trading system and global trade, I don't think anybody ever envisaged that we would be in this situation. I do believe that this is a very compelling moment for the continent of Africa to say, okay, AGOA is gone, markets have dried up, supply chains are disrupted, let's build our own domestic market. It may take some time, maybe 10 years or so, but we don't have an alternative. We have to build a domestic market so that young Africans, by the turn of the century, the youngest working force in the world will be in Africa.
So you've been quite vocal on the SACU agreement. And so from your observation, what exactly is the issue with this regional agreement?
Yeah, so look, I have been vocal on the SACU, not from a perspective that it doesn't have value for South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly does have value for South Africa. And I think that we ought to make sure that there is some better framework amongst the countries. And in fact, if anything, when we are looking in terms of trade perspective with the region, South Africa, as a bigger economy in the region, has benefited quite substantively on this.
Yes.
But I think we must remember when this agreement comes from. It comes from the from 1910, set in a very different context. There were some reviews that were minimal around the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
But now we are at a time where it's quite different from then. And I see SACU rather having a lot of problems for all of us in the region. One, we are supposed to be pivoting in this new geopolitical environment,
yeah.
looking for new friendships and signing a number of trade agreements. And SACU is constraining to an extent. And two, around many other countries in the SACU relationship, not honoring the rules and mm-hmm. blocking exports every now and then. And I find those to be problematic.
Yes, yes. And Namibia is one of those countries that sometimes blocks South African imports for certain times of the year. So now with this new African Continental Free Trade Area that is supposed to be implemented within the continent, do you think the SACU agreement needs revising, or should it be terminated altogether now that we have this Continental Free Trade Area?
Look, I think that in the SACU agreement, there must be a bit of an agreement that it does need some bit of a revision.
Mm-hmm.
There is a replication. We'll find ourselves stuck in the spaghetti because the African Continental Free Trade Agreement does offer us all now a tariff-free access. So one can ask a question and saying, what is the SACU for then? The other aspect that is related to this is the fact that we can still have some flexibility, but make sure that we untangle each other so that if Namibia wants to negotiate a trade agreement with a particular country by themselves,
yeah.
they have a flexibility to do that. If Swaziland wants the same, they have a flexibility to do that. But at the moment, it's a fact that none of us actually have the flexibility to do that. But at the same time, you have countries pursuing other interests amongst each other. So that's really the basis for me. And I think that we need to go back to the drawing board and see how do we modernize it.
Mm-hmm. And just for the listeners, because I know some will be asking this, is there any form of punishment or anything that happens if a country doesn't follow what has been agreed in the SACU agreement?
Look, the other thing I want to underline on why I'm reluctant on saying abandon SACU, the reality is also the fact that the likes of Namibia, Botswana, Swaziland, and Lesotho, they benefit on what is called the revenue sharing here.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the share of the budget that the government of Namibia or Botswana or and Swaziland actually get out of the revenue that is raised in this relationship, it's quite significant. So politically, there will be a reluctance. But I also think that as a major economy, South Africa, it would be irresponsible to say you are pulling the carpet under people's legs. You really need a way of saying, okay, the revenue aspect, we can find an elegant way of how we manage that. But at the same time, we untangle each other so that we are able to pursue our trade ambitions on this. The issue around the disputes of saying how do we handle some of the misbehaviors is exactly where it's not clear, because we've had instances where Namibia and Botswana mm-hmm. have said that they are blocking vegetables and fruit from South Africa for no apparent reason of saying, no, they want to boost their own domestic production.
Yeah.
But the rules do not allow that. They say you can block if there is a national security issue or any other thing like that, which is usually not the case. And I think that has brought also a lot of discontent about this relationship.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, let's move on to AGOA. I want to ask you about AGOA. It's been extended for another year. So now, given the bullish and maybe some would say coercive negotiating tactics of the USA, do you still think that Africans should prioritize this agreement or start looking elsewhere?
I mean, look, I think as Africans, we don't have the luxury to actually abandon certain interaction and say we'll prioritize others.
Mm-hmm.
As a small, as a region of small economies, we ought to actually ensure that we embrace relationships everywhere. And the fact that the U.S. has extended this, we should enjoy that part, but at the same time, try to seek a sustainable way of engagement. I mean, if I'm thinking now purely about my own country in South Africa, we are facing a 30% tariffs.
Yeah.
So effectively, they've eroded the benefit of AGOA. Had we not have AGOA, the tariffs would have been at 33%. Mm-hmm. But I think as a region, we ought to think about, one, how do we find a trade deal with the US? But at the same time, though, to your point, I think you are right, hedging our bets and thinking about how do we deepen trade with China, just like Canada is doing.
Yeah.
How do we deepen trade with the EU and many others in the Middle East?
Most definitely, most definitely. And speaking now of the region, I want to go back to the AFCFTA. When it comes now to its implementation, I feel that its implementation has been rather slow. So what do you think needs to be done to make this agreement fully work and so that the continent can reap the benefits that are at least proposed on paper?
Look, I think as a continent, there's a reality we must face here. And let's make an example of agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few countries in the continent that actually have surplus in agriculture. It is South Africa, Namibia in livestock and the other products. Then you have Zambia to a certain extent. And then you then have a lot of countries in the Maghreb region, Egypt and the others. You have many of the other countries in the middle where they are not really having a lot of products to export.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one thing of lowering tariffs and saying, okay, everyone can export, but you must have a product that you can put to market. And many of the countries do not have the product.
Yeah.
So you have to approach it in two ways where you can say, how can we ambitiously improve Africa's agricultural productivity? Better genetics in animal and better seed cultivars on crop and bringing in the technology. And as that is happening, then we also deepen trade and then there's shared prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, for me, we can finalize the all of the terms of engagement, but we must realize that politically, that also always presents some challenges because there are countries that actually thrived for a long period on raising revenue through the minimal tariffs that they impose.
Mm-hmm.
When you then take that away, while at the same time they haven't thought thoroughly about how they improve their agricultural productivity
yeah.
or productivity in other sectors, that presents challenges.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that insight. And lastly, my last question for you, speaking of other sectors, I want to get your view on how Africa can position itself in the global market beyond being a supplier of raw materials. I know this is an ongoing conversation, but just like to get your thoughts on that.
I mean, I think this is a long and an ongoing conversation, but I like the fact that it is sustained because one of the generation will probably start to do some work.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I would build on a previous point where I said, ensuring that we bring technologies to improve agricultural productivity, but going beyond that and saying, how do we increase the processing and the agribusinesses and leaning on some of the development finance institutions, either it's a BRICS bank, it's an African Development Bank, it's an African Bank, and all of the others. But I think for the manufacturing to take place, there's a role that the public sector needs to do. Manufacturing
yeah.
is not going to take place if the public sector is not maintaining the roads, the railway line, and the ports, because you can manufacture, but then how are you going to move this product to another part of your country or to the exports? So there has to be a coordinated approach here. The aspirations, but also domestic policies, especially on improving the network industries, roads, railway line, power supply, because without the large part of the energy and investments in the energy supply, the processing part is not going to take a hold. So we must invest on water, energy, as well as the roads and the railway line and the ports. And thereafter, we will see a lot of moves in the manufacturing space.
Most definitely. I couldn't agree more. Wandile, thank you very much for your time. And can you let the people know where they can find your newsletter and so on?
Thank you so very much. And they can be able to find me on my newsletter. It's Wandile, W-A-N-D-I-L.
And welcome.
How much you should stop making jokes before we get back on there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I need a filter at this point. Welcome back from... welcome back to Home Run. It's 18 past the hour of 5 here, and we are still here until the hour of 6. If you just tuned in, you're just a little late for the two audios that we played. One coming from, actually, two that we played. One coming from the World Economic Forum, from Mr. Wamkele Wamkele Mane.
Mane and
Mane
and Johan Strydom.
Johan Strydom. Yeah, Wamkele Mane is of the AFCFTA, and Johan Strydom is of Old Mutual South Africa.
Mm.
And then we have HT and Wandile on one side. Now, both discussions, basically both audios are based on the same thing, that is the state of Africa's economy as it is now and where we are headed economic growth-wise.
And sort of like, and if we can call it like the troll actions that countries can take between each other, which obviously is the SACU discussion. I have to sort of like highlight also in that, in the Wandile, Sihlobo interview with our colleague Hende, the relationship is a lot more nuanced between the countries.
Namibia and South Africa?
Namibia, Botswana and South Africa.
Yeah.
We obviously know it.
Oh, with the SACU discussion.
With the SACU discussion. And how you as a Namibian have to view this primarily is that you've got to look at these four countries together. Do not look at Namibia, Botswana, South Africa, and Lesotho as separate nations. They are sovereign, yes. But there's a reason why this is the oldest bloc, the oldest customs union in the world. The idea here is primarily you see the particular benefit as a consumer, you see the benefit in your price. Do not look at the political rhetoric or the discussions, even, for example, like Sihlobo highlighted, you know, it'll be a bit premature for South Africa to go and say that, you know, let me pull the rug out of from out under Namibia and Botswana, or the actions obviously of Namibia and Botswana, where we intermittently do the border closure discussions and close the border. And I myself have looked at that discussion. We've had the interviews here with people from the Namibia Agronomic Board as well. It's not always the best measure, Helmut, because if you've got a big economy like South Africa to the south of you, or to the north, or to the west, or the east, and you do these protectionist measures, which are intermittent protectionist measures. And remember, the biggest employers in Namibia, and for some reason, I don't know why the Ministry of Labor has not come out yet to clearly state things, you know, in terms of what are the labor, sort of like the labor allocations or labor distributions across the Namibian economy. But Namibia Statistics Agency has pointed this out, that out of the employed people in the country, the people employed, remember the labor force survey?
Yeah.
The employed people in the country are predominantly employed in the retail sector of the country. So retail has a strong position. Retail is dominated by South African businesses, not Namibian businesses.
Yeah.
Retail is literally the element, as I've said so many times in the Home Run, that displays the best of development, meaning if your town grows, then a property developer sees, okay, I need to go build a mall or something that looks like a shopping center, and then invite these South African businesses to come and open up a shop or branch in that location.
Yeah.
And so far the South Africans are the best, sort of like the best proponents for Namibia's developmental needs. You now walk into the discussion highlighting and trying to understand, okay, so what does SACU do? And I just explained to you what SACU just now does. It employs a lot of Namibians. This is not just about looking at data and just blindly thinking the data resembles or illustrates the complete picture. It doesn't. Because Helmut, you can now go to just here behind us, Hida's shopping center, and you can go count all the South African businesses there that employ Namibians.
Yeah.
From the Shell service station on the front, which was an engine, to the Checkers here behind, to the Debonairs and the what and so forth businesses.
Yeah.
They're South African, with one or two exceptions being the Voermanbrock on the other side. And I think even the KFC on the other side is also, for Africa, the Africa strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't come out of Namibia. It comes out of South Africa. the Africa strategy for most businesses you see in Namibia comes out of South Africa. So they would be headquartered in South Africa. Even the, where's the bank branch close by to us? I mean, even in that scenario, you see the benefits that Namibia keeps accruing.
Yeah.
We accrue the benefits because the South Africans know they need to open up an office here, which needs to have local joint venture illustrations or elements, and Namibians need to be employed and Namibians need to be empowered. I mean, I listened earlier for the article I submitted for tomorrow's The Villager e-paper. I listened to the panel discussion of the EITI discussion. And the lady from the Chamber of Mines, Lauren Graham, she's the chief economist with the Chamber of Mines. She said she heard that earlier that morning of that Thursday last week,
yeah.
She attended another event where she heard, for example, that the Chinese mining companies that operate in the DRC the workforce on the site is 80 to 90% Chinese that they had to bring in, that DRC allows. But when you come to Namibia, the Chinese companies in Namibia have the opposite spectrum. We meaning that all of Namibia's trade partners know when they come to Namibia, establish a joint venture, meaning local Namibian content, and hire local Namibian labor force representatives to work for your company.
Yeah.
So Namibia is already accruing these particular benefits. And in many scenarios, I know, Helmut, I'm going on a little bit of a rant in terms of
the you're doing great.
But because of the frustration specifically of how people understand SACU relationship. Yes, we've got an intricate relationship and an intricate history with South Africa. But it's not to say we need to throw the history and the relationship away. I've continuously said we can use the relationship and the history to our benefit. For some reason, some Namibians still continue to look to other parts of the world. For example, even those that come and tell you about AGOA. And then I still tell you, AGOA doesn't mean anything for you if you can only sell salt and beef. What else can you send to America, Helmut? And now, the American ambassador is literally acting like our best salesperson for the American mining sector,
yeah,
and the American oil companies. Don't worry, guys. It's just pretty far away, but it's pretty loud.
Yeah.
So he's doing his own scenario there, the American ambassador to Namibia. But if you just look at the relationship between Namibia and South Africa, it's probably the best relationship that exists in the world. We're probably way better than Canada and America.
There are two things that there's one thing that Twendile pointed out that is that I think can be applied to both Namibia's relationship with South Africa and Africa's relationship with both the East and the West.
Yeah,
yeah. Even though because when you look at it, this is with regards to AGOA. Yeah, this is with regards to AGOA. But I think it can apply to South Africa and to the SACU discussion.
Yes.
When it comes to sort of like, if you look at the state of geopolitical relationships where might is right now.
As of February 12 February 2026, ne? We're not talking about 3 January, Helmut.
We are now from here going forward. Yeah, because the relationship, obviously, the multipolarity seems to be taking place. Now there's an option for a lot of countries. They can decide to choose in terms of both diplomatic and economic relations. They can decide to go west or east.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now,
even in NATO, ne?
Yeah.
It's currently happening in NATO as well.
Canada.
Not just Canada. Did you hear what Europe is now doing?
What are they doing?
Europe is now promoting European tech companies.
Uh-huh.
Helmut, there's an active campaign. Look, I follow some EU government related Facebook accounts on my Facebook profile.
Yeah.
Because Instagram is such a useless application. I'm sorry, guys, who are Instagram fans, but it's a useless application.
No, Instagram is where you go if you want to see people with less clothes on.
But those are the other Mama 2000s. I don't follow Mama 2000s. I use social media for what social media should be, you know, sort of like broadening my scope of information sets, not to see I'm a 2000s who barely wear clothes, Helmut.
Yeah. That's,
then it's just, and it's a glorified something else platform. And I don't want to use that other name, but yeah, it's a glorified XXX platform.
I have at least five platforms.
But yeah. So the European Union, after what France had started doing, because France must went and disconnected some of, literally said no more, American tech companies would be technically present anymore in the French cyberspace.
Yeah.
So the EU is now actively promoting. Helmut, have you ever seen anyone in this world say, instead of Google, you can now use this? Some of these things I've never seen before.
So it's an open war.
It's literally now open trade warfare taking place between the EU and the US and Canada and the US. And Canada is literally doing all the opposite actions. Literally signing the trade agreement that they signed with China. With
China, yeah.
And then the next day it was Maduro'd in, on 3 January. There was Maduro. Cause, Carney went, was and signed that the agreement was with China.
Yeah.
And then the Chinese dignitaries was in Venezuela to talk to Maduro. But then Maduro got Maduro'd.
And
the Chinese delegation was stuck in Venezuela. The guys were apparently stuck in Venezuela.
Yeah.
While those things were kicking off, Helmut. Now, talk about putting someone else's diplomats in danger, or, you know, in close to, you know, element of danger.
Remember the bombing of Belgrade?
But that was most the whole embassy. And the Chinese have not forgotten.
No, they haven't. So that was just making
like,
it worse.
Just like they have not forgotten the Boxer Rebellion, as they call it. And the opium wars.
Oh, no,
because
yeah,
they keep bringing, because they keep bringing it up at official platforms with especially the EU and the United States. Well, especially with the EU, because it was the British that instigated, especially the opium wars.
Yeah.
And the British roped in the other European powers, like the French and the Germans.
Yeah.
But, if you put the history aside, the multipolarity, you are right.
Yeah.
Now, here's the particular crux of the issue for Africa and countries like Namibia. Namibia currently, Hamid, we're probably that 5-year-old toddler that is being offered sweets by all aunts and uncles in the family.
Yeah.
Who are the aunts and uncles? So you have the mainstay guardian, South Africa, who is supplying the whole menu of food, plus confectionery goods. Then we've got the Chinese aunt showing up with baked goods. And then you've got the German and EU aunts showing up with the other confectionery sugar-induced goods, you know, to sort of like amplify our sweet tooth appetite. The downside of this relationship is we are saying yes to all three, to all four.
If you ask me, I agree with that statement, because that's what Wandile points out, that do we really have the luxury to take a peek? Like, because for one, we already have established trade relationships going back decades with the US and the EU bloc.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we are in the, you know, we have some newly established and still looking forward to establishing more trade and diplomatic relations with the Western bloc.
Yeah.
Now we are talking about, mostly China in this case.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the question is, do we really have to pick one? Because whatever is going on between the US and China, if you ask me, it's none of our business.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
It isn't.
So if there's something that we have that the Chinese want, we can trade.
Yeah.
If there's something that they have that we want, we can trade.
Yeah.
If there's something that they, the same can go for the EU bloc and the same can go for the US.
But like we highlighted already, the behavior of the EU bloc is more like, no, Africa, you must just stay in our corner. And we as Africans are going like, you know, this relationship is uncomfortable. But we know this relationship.
No, look, they are telling us to, that's like your friends coming to you to say, you know what, well, that guy and I, you know, we hate each other. Now,
But we know each other.
Yeah, we know each other. You and that guy have never interacted. Mm. You just have to hate them because I hate them.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to hate them, via proxy.
Nem and Helmut, your example doesn't make sense. It's more like a relationship. It's two people that have dated.
They have
animosity between
the relationship went south.
It keeps going south in many intervals. It has a historic time frame. It keeps going south in many intervals.
Yeah.
But they know each other and they are so comfortable with each other. And that's the relationship literally between Africa and Europe.
Yeah.
And we are just too happy to say yes to participate in the Global Gateway initiative. We were just too happy to go and sign the Samoa Agreement, which
Joint Vision 2030.
Which is literally the thing that says, yes, Caribbean, Africa, Pacific, and Pacific Islands, Asian areas, just sign.
And then
we just signed for no reason. I mean, people should have asked the question about, now why are the South Americans not here?
No, we don't do that. We just sign.
And people should have asked questions, why is Southeast Asia not here? Between in that area of, that neighborhood of between India and just below China.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they also not here? No. Namibia, we just, Africa, we just went and signed. Okay. So we now sit with that issue, Helmut.
We can't keep doing this.
No, we can't. But we also need to realize we can't continuously look at things outside, which is the nice thing that Wamkele Mene mentioned.
Yeah.
Even though he said 3 weeks back when that talk took place, AGOA is done. Even though AGOA was literally just renewed after that just for this year. Yeah. It was just extended for this year that we heard obviously in the Sihlobo discussion by Hende. The concern here is Africans will have to prove to the Donald Trump administration value-added products, meaning Africans will have to invest in things so that they can firstly can import, have the ability, have the money to import products of value addition from the United States. Otherwise, it'll be lopsided or one-sided agreements being a scenario of, okay, so if you want to trade with us, you must give us preferential treatment in your extractive industries. Now, this is going to be a big concern because that's the whole reason why Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger are acting the way they are. It's going to be a big concern because already if you look at those three countries, Helmut,
yeah,
it literally looks like the AFCFTA idea, the AU idea, the ECOWAS idea, is busy fragmenting because of those three countries.
Yeah.
We're already treating Morocco for some reason the way we are treating Morocco because back in 2022, and I don't understand why our own president, was there and,
remember that speech.
And literally said yes to this thing. And I couldn't understand why are you lambasting Morocco, who's a kingdom, about, Western Sahara if the UN doesn't want to even want to recognize Western Sahara. And it's a dispute. The whole dispute is literally between Mauritania and Morocco over Western Sahara. Helmut? It's literally a, what do I call that word? Almost a diplomatic nightmare, but it's literally a geopolitical nightmare internally for Africa. But before we continue, guys, we quickly have to take a live read. Mvita University, for the 2026 applications that are now extended for the Faculty of Health Sciences. For the following courses, Certificate in Health Science Foundation, Diploma in Environmental Health Science, Postgraduate Diploma in Community Health Nursing, Postgraduate Diploma in Mental Health, Postgraduate Diploma in Occupational Health and Safety, Master of Science in Occupational Health and Safety, and for the Master of Public Health. For more information, call 081-403-6406, Velvice University, where everyone is an achiever. So the nice thing is also when we've got to look at the stability elements that are taking place. Helmut, you wanted to make a point specifically about the fragmentation that is also taking place, and then I mentioned the NATO thing, and it's obviously creating the multipolarity that, started beginning from 2022. But SACU's existence is a benefit for us. SADC's existence is a benefit for us. And the AfCFTA plays directly into our ambitions. It plays directly into our ambitions because SADC has a clear policy document that says we wish to achieve the economic integration landscape as the mission and vision of SADC. And SACO has achieved that already. That's an integrated economic plan. And from there, we just, you know, the whole ambition should just be exported into SADC. From SADC, exported into AfCFTA or the rest of Africa.
Yeah.
But straight on Mehdi's point, if a company, if the private sector, for example, in Namibia, wants to expand into the rest of Africa, you have to deal current situation is 54 different economies with 54 different currencies, with 54 different sovereign identities. So it seems...
of an identity crisis.
Okay, that too as well. It seems the AU has to speed things up in terms of economic integration. And it seems like literally we have to bring back silencing the guns.
Oh, no, please don't stop.
To stop all these wars. Because really, Sudan, Ethiopia is happening again. The Tigray situation.
Yeah, I saw that.
Is once again flaring up. I mean, come on, Helmut. We really need to drop the strongman persona from in Africa. We really need to drop this.
So you have the Tigray, and you have
Sudan.
Sudan, both Sudan and South Sudan.
Yeah.
And that part of the continent is under severe drought as we speak.
Yeah. As well.
Yeah.
As well.
So you have the whole Somaliland recognition. Oh, by the way, did you know Somaliland recognition is in the Epstein files?
So it's a plan.
Have been for a very long time.
So that's why
just look at just how powerful was this guy. Because
it's now known.
It was
Mossad's idea. He's a Mossad informant. He's not a Mossad informant. He's literally a Mossad mole using obviously espionage terms.
Oh, the girlfriend's father was a former Mossad.
Who?
Ghislaine Maxwell.
No, yeah. her father was a former disgraced...
Disgraced,
because the father passed away after his media companies closed down.
Oh.
Yeah. So Ghislaine Maxwell was a trust fund baby who, after her father passed away, took whatever was left from the estate and then flew to the U.S. to go in, according to the source that I watched, to go and redo, to refine herself, you know, to go and rediscover herself.
And she didn't do a good discovery.
In New York, and she bumped into homeboy that had a lot of dubious references.
Yeah. Now, look.
You know, one of those references were in jail as well.
My favorite.
For a Ponzi scheme that was his idea.
No, look, my favorite part is how the whole thing is slowly becoming Russia's problem.
How? Look.
Western media never disappoints. Look, the thing is, what's going on here is that, Russia is mentioned, I'm not sure if it's Russia or the Russian president is mentioned in the file. Except, yes, the Russian president is mentioned in a reference to overthrowing the guy.
Him
participating.
Yeah, because what I also thought about was literally how in the mainstream media discussion so far from what I've seen is that there were references to Syria, not in the Epstein files, but back when the Arab Spring happened in 2010, 2011.
What's this? The Arab Spring also comes up a lot.
Yeah. After Libya, after Gaddafi after Libya was destabilized and Gaddafi obviously was removed by the same NATO forces, they then turned to Bashar al-Assad. And that's when Putin literally intervened for the first time, because Syria is just a hop, skip and a jump away from the Black Sea.
Yeah.
The Black Sea neighborhood. On the other side of Turkey, you find the Black Sea.
Yeah.
And Syria borders onto Turkey. And the biggest concern, obviously, would be because Syria borders also on the other side to Israel, would be, you know, how close do the American forces move to the Russian border?
Yeah.
And since Turkey is also already a NATO ally, and Turkey keeps doing that weird thing, they say yes to being an ally, but they buy Russian military hardware, and everyone is asking why the Turkish buying Russian missile defense systems and not American promoted missile defense systems through NATO. And then everyone is asking Turkey, Erdogan, what are you doing? And Erdogan is like, listen, guys, I have the most difficult relationship in this neighborhood. I have to allow Russian ships to move through my port facility.
Do you understand what I'm dealing
with? Do you understand how difficult this relationship is? And then obviously,
oh, it's a geographical location situation that is caught up.
Yeah, it's a it's an ugly geography. It's an ugly geopolitical, and it's an ugly temperature to deal in if you're stuck in that neighborhood. So, if you've ever wondered why Putin and Netanyahu or Putin and any other Israeli prime minister have never had like direct relations on a positive note with each other, is primarily because from Syria 2011 heading this direction. That was when the schism literally became very obvious to anyone in the world, when the Russians said, listen, we're going to put our foot down with you guys trying to destabilize Syria.
Oh,
that's why you had the Russians defending one side of the oil fields of Syria. The Syrian forces were around Damascus. The rebels, which also included the ISIS guys, were in the middle, and the Americans were literally siphoning off oil alongside the Turkish forces from the part closest, the part of Syria.
Is it the Golden Heights?
No, the Golan Heights is in Israel, but it's the part that the Israelis took from the Six-Day War in the 70s or in the 60s from Syria. That part of southern Israel that they took from Jordan and Egypt. Because the one war was most the Israeli-Arab war, I think, of the 60s or the 70s, where the coalition of Arabic countries, which included Egypt, Jordan, the Kingdom of Jordan, Syria. Was it Lebanon? No, it wasn't Lebanon, because Lebanon has a large Christian population. But they all literally said, listen, we will invade, you know, Israel back then. And then that first sort of like 6 or 7 day war, it's not, because they're literally like 2 6-day wars that Israel fought. Now, the first one was literally, they literally beat up 3 armies in 1 week.
That's savage.
They stopped the northern advance of the Syrians, Bashar al-Assad's father.
Yeah.
Stopped the northern advance of the Syrians, and they took the Golan Heights, which is now occupied by Israeli settlements. They stopped the Jordanian / Egyptian advance from the south, and they literally and they also took land from both countries. And that's most one of the reasons why the Jordanians are technically the most diplomatic between all those three nations, because the Egyptians are paid now by the Americans as development financing for their army. But the Jordanians, still obviously maintaining their kingdom, when they took in a lot of Palestinian refugees after that first war, the Palestinians almost overthrew the Jordanian monarchy, which has now been proven specifically in human dynamics, you know, people, immigration or refugees moving a lot, that if you have a large allocation of refugees from one country in your country and they outnumber your population, or they get to a level where they probably can compete for resources with the indigenous population, they can literally destabilize your country. And the Palestinians did it in Lebanon, and they did it in Jordan.
The Europeans did it in North America, South America. I mean, the list is very long.
Okay, if we're talking about, Which is the other scenario. But those guys were they were not refugees, the Europeans.
Yeah, they were just immigrants that just soldiered in. Step one, reduce the population so that you are more than them, and then
dominate. The world's two known largest companies in the world ever did, the Dutch and the British East India companies.
Those guys
were savage.
Those guys, I think that's the point you just made is it's a power thing.
It is a power thing.
Yeah, it's a power dynamic. Power corrupts, but absolute power is even worse. So corrupts even more.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm gonna collapse, but collapse. Now,
okay, but who actually has absolute power?
It's more. I'm using absolute power in reference to, when you look. The state that they take, for example, the U.S. is now.
Yeah.
The U.S. was struggling to survive from the British when the British was at the top of their game,
and the actual ally of the Americans before. You know, the First World War or before 1900 was actually the French French monarchy.
There's really no fixed political relationship, is there? Because today they're allies, tomorrow they're enemies.
Because actually, if you look in human history, Hamoud, today, the concept of democracy we've practiced today is the French Revolution template, not the American Revolution template. So what is the American Revolution template? The American Revolution template was breaking away from colonialism. Ne?
Yeah.
Which is the one that Namibia, the same idea that Namibia also achieved our independence from, breaking away from colonialism.
Yeah.
But the installation of things that we see in our country in terms of how we self-determine ourselves and, you know, exercise stuff with a constitution and stuff is the French Revolution template, representing the needs of everyone, even the lowest of the low in society. Not the, okay, now we broke away, only us the rich guys and the farm owners and the slave owners can make decisions.
Clarify that the French Revolution template minus the guillotine.
If you observe some of the demonstrations we've had since COVID, Helmut, this way, it was close to probably someone saying, you know, let's bring back the guillotine. But then, you know, we've got strong institutions in that regard.
Thank heavens.
Yeah. So currently we're practicing the French Revolution template.
Yeah.
Have a constitution that represents everyone's rights. It's most the American Constitution that didn't have rights for Black Americans up until the 1950s and 60s, which was the reason why what's his name, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, them literally were becoming the activists they were, and then which still till the day also has certain particular elements of discrimination contained in it. But anyway,
you know what's interesting.
Yeah.
Just one fun fact. The interracial relationship, the interracial marriage case that led to the legalization of cross-racial marriages in the state of Virginia is known as the Loving case. It was a case of a gentleman called Richard.
His surname was Loving.
Yeah.
I know, Helmut. They've got like these old English names.
Mildred Loving. I was like,
they've got like these old English names.
The judge was waiting for this case. His whole career.
I mean, in America, if you go look at some surnames and the stuff, you'll find like old English surnames. You go like, does this name really exist? And if you go to like, for example, like surnames like Remington and stuff like that. Okay, yeah. they're obviously.
Oh, when it comes to those names.
Yeah.
Now I totally understand Zimbabwe names. Love more, really? There's Loveless. Okay.
That's not the reason why that name.
Just asking.
Before we continue, let's take another short live read. Velvita University for the 26 applications that are now extended for the following faculty. The Faculty of Health Sciences for the following courses. Certificate in Health Science Foundation, Diploma in Environmental Health Science, Postgraduate Diploma in Community Health Nursing, Postgraduate Diploma in Mental Health, Postgraduate Diploma in Occupational Health and Safety, Master of Science in Occupational Health and Safety, and the Master of Public Health. For more information, call 081-403-6406. Velvety University, where everyone is an achiever.
Welcome back. We have 6 minutes left to the hour of 6 minutes left to the hour of six, and this is Homerun with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM here until, well, here for the, just for the last 6 minutes. And coming back to the state of, you know, like the direction that Africa must take in terms of its diplomatic, diplomatic foreign relations, whatever, however you want to describe it, and economic relations. I agree with, what's that gentleman's last name?
Which one? Mene or Sitlobo?
Sitlobo, yeah. I totally agree with that gentleman when he said, look, one, I know that he says that we don't have the luxury, which again, we don't have the luxury to basically pick one, one global power over the other, because we have ongoing relations between them. I know that the one emerging in the middle here, especially the EU guys, are very pissed. They want to, they want us to pick a side, but we have done this before. Remember, friend to all, enemy to none. Now when you look at it like that, I think, all we just have to do is, tell them, look, whatever beef you guys have, that's on you. But for us, we are open to trade with both of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to help us for so long, Helmut. Especially Namibia's particular international relations approach and policy. What is actually going to help us a lot if we look at continent-wide development? Okay, first and foremost, the first particular beneficiaries of EU or Europe and Africa benefits would obviously be Namibia, South Africa, Botswana in to an extent, mm-hmm. with, because of the just energy transition and the green hydrogen projects that are taking place, and the North African countries that are closest to Europe, mm-hmm. from Egypt to Morocco, because primarily they are just across from the Mediterranean Sea, and they've known each other for thousands of years. The biggest concern would be, how do we actually integrate things across the continent to connect Southern Africa to Northern Africa through the middle of Africa? And if you've got war zone hotspots in the middle, or unresolved issues like South Sudan, Sudan, Chad, Central African Republic, parts of Eastern DRC with Rwanda, or parts of Western Africa, where the three guys, the breakaway guys from ECOWAS are, because at the heart of everything, Helmut, you at least as a Namibian sitting here in Windhoek 2026, you would like to, like I've said before, the vision that I myself have, to ride a train from Windhoek to, let's say, you want to go see Lagos. You want to ride a train from Windhoek to Lagos, you're along the west coast of Africa. And you'll see all the beautiful places, meet all the nice people from Africa. And then the funny thing is, of that World Economic Forum discussion with Mene and Strijdom, was the American journalist that said, when he turned to, what was the guy's name? Yeah, when he turned to back to Mene, to Wamkile, when he turned back to Wamkile, and he said, you know what? I never knew that when Africans were telling him that you can't fly from one side of Africa to another side of Africa without going through Paris. And he said, no, that's not true. And literally, he flew to Paris to come back to Africa, literally spending 24 hours of flying, almost 24 hours.
There is no direct flight.
Because there's no direct flight. Yeah. And that had been our discussion of the Yamoussoukro Declaration, remember?
Yeah.
The connecting, the plan of Africa to connect the skies of Africa to each other. But it's taking so slow, Helmut. We have more European operators in Namibian airspaces than South African operators.
I think we are better starting with a rail.
We are better starting with rail and the road. We are better starting with those two.
But, road and rail.
But here's the thing, Helmut. You don't have time to drive 3 days of your life.
Forget road.
From Windhoek.
Let's go with rail.
To Nairobi.
Yeah.
You don't have that much time in your life to spend on a road on a train track. So if you've got the money, let's for example say, to fly to, let's go see, you want to go party on those lovely beaches of Liberia or Sierra Leone or Ivory Coast.
Yeah.
They've got some beautiful people over there. So, or even Ghana.
No, the distance between.
No, Ghana. I think Ghana is the party spot to be.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
I think Ghana is the party spot to be. So if you fly.
I've seen a few of them walk away.
What are you doing?
Nothing.
What are you doing? What are we? But yeah, you'd like to fly there.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want to have 3 days out of a week on by road or by train, getting there to Accra.
Yeah, your boss is calling you. You know, your leave is over halfway through. You're just somewhere in DRC,
and you barely arrived at your destination. So, you'd at least like to find. You know, you'd like to have the options, just like you've got the options in Europe.
Yeah.
Now, nobody wants to do, obviously, a Che Guevara driving an
airplane. And also, you have to understand, in comparison to Africa, to Europe, Africa is huge by land mass.
It's massive.
It's massive, yeah.
So you obviously don't want to do an Ernesto Che Guevara on a motorcycle, and you even give the motorcycle the name of the mighty one, driving from Cape to Cairo. It's going to be far. Yeah. And so there are roads, there are places where the roads don't even exist.
Nope.
There's currently a guy that I see even popping up on my YouTube timeline who's driving from, he's driving from what part of, it's along this west coast of Africa. He's driving from, I think it was from Paris or Lisbon or Madrid, but he's driving from Europe to Cape Town.
Okay.
Along this western, the west coast of Africa.
Yeah, but you'll have to go through the Middle East.
No, you can take a ferry. The closest point between Spain and Morocco is literally like 5 kilometers wide. And it's also the shallowest.
I thought he was just cycling by landmass.
No. He's driving with a BMW 5 Series from 1998 or 1999. That just has better tires.
Yeah, he just picked something that's more mechanical than it is electronic. That's a brilliant idea.
So he's driving with his BMW from all the way from Paris to Cape Town, and he's driving along this way. Now, he's currently now in Nigeria, the person. Now,
it's a very white people thing to do, but go on.
The roads
are
all gravel.
Eh? Ask Anthony Joshua. One accident, then no one is coming to help you.
Anthony Joshua was even on a tar road when that accident happened, Halloween. It was a tar road.
At least the road was there. The ambulance was non-existent. Hey, we already cooked Nigerians on Twitter. Let's give them a break here.
South Africans at least helped us. That's what I'm happy for. Literally, South Africans.
Neighbors ride or die.
The South Africans came and helped. For some surprising reason, they even went like, let's help the Namibians with this argument. even though I have, you know, South African heritage in a way, but yeah, I'm grateful for that part, but yeah. So the way forward technically is that we have to achieve the goals set out at AFCFTA. But it's going to be a long road, Helmut.
It's going to be a long road because in both the discussion from Dubai with Tucker Carlson and the World Economic Forum on the economic perspective that we are looking at Africa from is one that again painfully extractive industry based
is being championed as the only sector, while looking to us, the Africans, or you know, internally, domestically, now we have to sort out the other sectors.
Yeah, and what's this? The Lobito Corridor Group was even referenced. I'm like, that's a train that's going to be shipping raw material out of the continent. So yes, it's a good economic investment. But none of these countries actually carried out the investment. It's a foreign investment.
Yeah.
Yes, you are selling. You have a market where you are selling your extractive material to in its raw form. Except that's not how you build long-term economic progress because, this resource is finite.
Yeah.
What happens when it runs out? Then the investors of that, of the whole infrastructure, we will not have any reason to invest in it anymore.
Mm.
He's just going to die a natural death.
Yep, yep.
So painfully, we're still stuck in the extractive industry. But let's take a quick break and then sign off on the other side. Then you stay tuned for the next program. But before that, let's take a quick break.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past,
mm.
and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. 4 minutes into the hour of six. That brings us to the end of Home Run for today. Until tomorrow, same time, same place on your favorite radio station. Eagle FM from me. You'll stay tuned for the next program and have a blessed evening.
And on that note, guys, enjoy the rest of your evening. Stay tuned after the break.